Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back with the 21st episode of our series, and we took about a two-week hiatus there from the 5th to the 21st, a little bit more than 2 weeks. I had quite a bit of work going on, and then I was on vacation, so here we are. We are back, and we are now into our top 80 films of all time. John tonight will be talking about his movie Burnt by the Sun, and I will be talking about 20th Century Women, Burnt by the Sun from 1994, 20th Century Women from 2016. John, it was a long 2 weeks. I watched one movie in the entire span because I was literally in a theme park. So if you count those movies, then maybe the best movie I watched this week was in there. But how was your movie going week this past 2 weeks?
I took a little break from watching movies because movie theaters finally opened again. So I actually got to go sit in a theater and watch a movie.
Yeah. And how glorious was that?
Oh, it was one of the most incredible feelings I have had in a very long time.
And for those who don't know, John is in Canada. So if you're in the US and you're like, wait a second, we've had movies open for a little bit. John is in Canada, so he's been waiting for this a long time, and pretty much every time we'd go for a pre-show, I would brag about, hey, man, yeah, I went and saw this movie in the theater, and John would pretty much want to kill me. So good that he was able to get back into theater. We'll talk about the best thing we saw over these past 17 days, which there's no competition for me because it was one movie other than Burnt by the Sun and 20th Century Women. So good for that movie. But we'll talk about that later. Let's start this one off with Burnt by the Sun from 1994, Russian movie, wins the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. And there's some controversy surrounding this movie and how it won Best Foreign Film, which I found out last night after watching the movie. John, I'm not sure. Are you familiar with the controversy surrounding this winning Best Foreign Film?
No.
So here you go. Burnt by the Sun had not actually released in America yet when the voting came up for Best Foreign Language Film. So because of that, they held a screening, and only the people who attended that screening were able to vote for the Best Foreign Language Film. After it was nominated, only those people were able to vote for their favorite one, and they all picked Burnt by the Sun. So no surprise there that Burnt by the Sun actually won. Now, not saying it didn't deserve it, but I just think it's funny that there's quite a bit of controversy surrounding it.
That's really interesting and a weird way to approach that situation.
Yeah, very, very. Send out screeners. Trust me, it's easy enough to get screeners these days. They're everywhere in Hollywood. If you think your movie is safe, it is not. But yeah, it won Best Foreign Film in 1994. John, why do you have it here at number 80 in your top 100?
I think this is one of the most beautiful films ever shot. And it means I really understand why I appreciate this film so much. You need to understand like my appreciation for Russian cinema, and particularly Soviet cinema that preceded Russian cinema, because 1994, this is one of the first big post-Soviet Union Russian films to come out of Russia. Mm. And leading into that, you had the Soviet culture was really built around cinema. They had a huge respect for film as an art form. And a lot of that derived from Lenin back at the very beginning of the Soviet Union, declaring it as the official art form of the Soviet Union because he viewed it so highly. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we've seen so many cinematic innovations come out of Russia through the last century. And just kind of see where it went after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the stories they could then tell because the Soviet Union no longer existed.
Yeah, I always find it interesting to see these directors and these actors and such who never make the transition to Hollywood because their careers are so much sparser than Hollywood type directors. I mean, even Denny Villeneuve, who I can never say his name. I always pronounce it wrong. So apologies to my Canadian friends named John. But, you know, he was a little less mainstream, and then he became more mainstream, and now he's, you know, fully in the mainstream. And so now he's picked up, but I look at like Genet, who we've talked about a couple times already on this podcast. When you look at his Genet film, he never really made it into the mainstream. He briefly did with Alien Resurrection and then Amelie, and then he kind of fell off again. And so his career is a little bit sparser. And that's the same thing with, apologies, Nikita Mikhalkov. I have no clue. I'm so sorry. But
Mikhailiev.
Thank you. So I would have never gotten there. But so when I look at him, the direction in this movie is phenomenal. His acting is phenomenal. And yet I'd never heard of him because I'd never seen this movie. And then it turns out that there was a sequel to this movie, which totally seems out of nowhere, considering they pretty much tell you everybody dies at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. I found out there was a sequel to this movie. And my only question was how, because that doesn't make sense with the way this movie concludes.
It doesn't make any sense. It literally makes none. And so I don't even want to know how. I won't watch it. I'll just take this as the only, as a standalone, as this is its own baby, and that's it. We'll just leave it at that, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to approach it anyways, because this, I love the story of this film. The plot of this film is incredible. It's such a character piece while still looking at the time surrounding the period where it takes place. We're never really given an exact year as to when it's taking place, but we can tell based on clues it's about 10 years removed from the Russian Civil War. For those of you who don't know, following the October Revolution in 1917, there was a 4-year civil war in Russia between the Red Bolsheviks and the White Loyalists and Tsarists for control of the country. And obviously the Bolsheviks won. And we know then a few years later, after Lenin dies, Stalin takes over. And at some point during the 1930s, this movie takes place. And it's really part of the Stalinist purges, where he started to purge the inner circles of the Bolshevik party to gain greater control.
Yeah, and it looks like, based on, I'm reading it over here, it looks like it's set in the summer of 36. So that seems to be where it's set, based on what it says on Wikipedia. So how right that is, I don't know. But yeah, and so not knowing much about Russian history, because we're not really taught that here at all. Really, all we ever get about Russia is like the 80s. So not really knowing much about Russian history, I thought this movie did a good job of not needing you to know a lot. All you need to know is that everybody's in a dire situation, even though this is a really nice summer day. We get the opening of Mitya playing Russian roulette and then deciding, you know what, I'll keep going because I didn't die. And there's a sense of foreboding that follows this movie all the way through. And I always like movies like this. This kind of reminds me of, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, or Everybody Wants Some in a Very Different Way, or even In the Mood for Love, where it's more about just the characters in the moment, and they don't even know what they're working towards. They still think everything is going to turn out okay because they can't see the future. But we have the ironic position of knowing the future. And the whole time, you know something bad is going to happen to Kotov. You know something bad's going to happen to him or his daughter or somebody in his family, because as the movie slowly unveils that he's the one who sent Mitya away and all that, that there's some sort of revenge plot going on here. This guy is not just here to be here, but it really takes its time and does it very artistically. And, you know, this is one of those movies that could have been told in a completely different manner. I appreciate that they stuck by what they were looking to go with and didn't make me feel like I was lost because I don't know Russian history.
Yeah. And that's kind of the nice way about how it's presented, because it's so focused on these familial relationships and this building story of the history between Mitya and Marussia. And just, they were former lovers, but now Marussia's married to Sergei. And they're trying to figure it out. And then we get Mitya's fairy tale where he just blatantly tells everyone that Sergei sent him away in the first place. And it just builds and escalates everything between these characters in such a way that everything starts kind of making more sense. When we first meet Mitya at the very beginning of the film, and he's playing the Russian roulette with himself. We don't know what's going on. We have no idea what's going on. But as we get through the film, the hints are laid out. And at the end of the film, we find out Mitya is working for the NKVD, which is the precursor to the KGB. And is there working at, on orders from the government to purge Sergei. For some reason, we don't know what reason, but that is just what was happening during that time period. And my interpretation of that opening scene because of that is that he didn't want to do this because he didn't want to, and it circles back at the end of the film when he commits suicide. He didn't want to do this because he was way too close to it.
Well, yeah, and he gets no satisfaction from carrying out the order that he carries out here. He ends up feeling just as bad afterwards as he did at the beginning. And whether it's revenge or whether it's just because he's put in this position and he doesn't have a choice, you know, he is portrayed as a coward throughout the movie. And that's what Sergei always says is he would have gone where he went, where Mitya went, because he loved his country, because he loved the motherland. Mitya went because he was scared. And now Mitya is working against pretty much his family or who he would consider his family because he's terrified, because he's scared that he'll be the one who gets killed. And, you know, that's always the scary thing with totalitarianism anyway. And, you know, it's been going on for thousands of years and, you know, it happens all the time, but that's why I think there's so many people who get scared of like free speech being taken away or what social media is able to do and all that, because social media at the end of the day is totalitarian, because they can say, you know what, I don't like that, let's get rid of it. And they get rid of it. They don't have to explain to you why. Now, obviously, there's a big difference between removing a tweet and shooting somebody, like what happened at the end of this movie. But it is one of those things where how many, like, at what point does it hit this point? Because, you know, we always hear about burning of the books and burning of that. And this movie does a really good job of capturing all that, but setting it not in this typical, we're so used to Russian movies being cold and being distant and being more of the future science fiction. We're so used to them being these grand epics that are either set against the snow or they're set in space or something like that. And instead we're getting a bright, sunny movie that feels like Call Me By Your Name or something shot in the south of France. And that different feeling, it's like the winter is coming. Don't worry. It'll be there soon. And it's almost like, you know, the movie itself, Burnt by the Sun. I understand that that's about, you know, being burned by the government. But I almost feel like the film in this movie is burnt by the sun. It is so oversaturated. It is so overly yellow and orange the entire time. But, you know, it's a very interesting stylistic take. And 27 years later, a movie that's about 60 years before it was made, now 27 years later, still has that. It can still resonate with you of, man, everybody seems to be scared that, you know, they're not being told accurate information or that somehow they're going to be betrayed and killed or screwed over, or have their livelihoods taken away from them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's such a brilliant idea to have this movie set in the summer because, like you said, the summer months are almost never depicted when we're talking about Russia, Russian film or films taking place in Russia. And there's a very big beauty to the Russian landscape that is missed when we don't look at it in the summer. I mean, I'm sitting here, it's like 86 degrees, like 90 degrees here today. And I watched this movie earlier today, and just the river scene looked so refreshing to me. And it's just such a beautiful scene. And then they're swimming in it, and they go into those trees there. And it just feels so crisp and clean and freeing, but it's all contrasted by this big, ominous sense of dread that hangs over the entire film.
Yeah, and it's always interesting to watch movies set in places that we have such a distinct perception of. Because Russia, when you think about it in America, it's even like I watch a show like The Americans, which, you know, coming on FX, if you haven't watched it, it's a phenomenal show. Anybody who hasn't seen that, great show about the Cold War era and Soviet spies in America. It is so well done. But when I watch them like that, I feel like that entire show is set in the winter always, even though it's taking place in DC and in Alexandria and the areas around there, it still feels like the entire thing is taking place in Russia because we think of Russia as it's just winter all the time. But what's funny is Russia shares longitude, right? No, latitude, because latitude's like a ladder. It shares latitude with a lot of Europe. And we don't always think of Europe as cold and miserable. Like even a country like Finland, which is very cold and very much north, people still can say, oh yeah, there's summer there. You can imagine what summer would look like in Sweden or Finland or something like that. But in Russia, it always just seems like, nope, doesn't happen. It's Siberia. Everybody's just going to freeze to death and die. So I loved watching this movie just for that absolute opposite. That absolute opposite, instead of showing the days where it's 18 hours of nighttime, they're showing the days where it's 18 hours of daylight and how even in those long days, there's still something that could happen and go wrong. Even when you think, you know, this is my one day off and what could possibly happen today?
Yeah. And that's the other decision that's so good in this film is that they just decided to make it this one day where this person's off. How easy would it have been for this film and like the end goal of this to happen on a day where he's working, right? But they decided not to. They made the artistic decision to make it focus instead on the family. And really, most of this film is focused on Nadia and just kind of her perception of it. And that's how we're seeing the film, is with this childlike innocence to everything that's going around. Yes, we're introduced to this idea that that Mitya and Marussia were former lovers, despite the 10-year age difference and like knowing each other when they were incredibly young. But everything is due through with this childlike innocence, and a lot of that comes through with the setting and the lighting and the shots in this film. But in the end, this is a really depressing movie.
Oh, yeah. Like, the whole thing. And I think for it to try to keep a positivity throughout the entire first half, throughout most of this movie, and then ultimately come back and say, okay, now we're going to get depressing, but it's going to be so late. Like, to me, the ending really stayed with me and elevated the movie up until, like, I really appreciate everything before it, but the ending to me, it's like, all right, I have to remind myself that like I did not love the rest of this movie as much as I love this ending, because you're so quick when you're blown away in the end. You know, it's the whole adaptation thing of wow them in the end. That's all you got to do. And how many times do movies do that where it just has that ending where you say, wow, I got to watch that again. And then you watch the whole movie again. And you're like, well, that wasn't as good. It's really all in the ending. And I'm not saying that's what Burnt by the Sun, but I had to remind myself like, well, that ending is a 10 out of 10. The rest of the movie to me was like a 7.5 out of 10 or something like that. Yeah. And so when I was ranking, when I went to go and rate it on Letterboxd and everything, I'm like, all right, just remember the ending, which is staying with you and like blowing your mind. You got to watch this movie again now knowing the ending and see if you have a different opinion on it. Because I did feel at times it took a little too long to get where it was going. But when it has that impactful of an ending, well, maybe it's okay that it was such a lazy day movie. And, you know, another movie I said earlier, but Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has a very similar through line where it's the day before, the days leading up to Sharon Tate being murdered. Now, knowing that Sharon Tate is going to be murdered, even though she isn't, the fact that you know it's coming allows for you to sit there and really appreciate the fact of like, huh, they're just being a lazy summer day. They don't even know the impending doom that's coming. Not knowing Kotov or what was going to happen, perhaps rewatching it, knowing that will make me appreciate everything that comes before it even more, because I mean, it's so stylistically like subdued and just, it's taking its time in every way, shape and form that it should be taking its time.
Yeah. And Mikhailiev made that. It's a very conscious decision for Mikhailiev to do that because they chew these scenes and they extend them as long as possible. I definitely get that criticism of the film because there are scenes that seem like they are taking forever in this film. But I just find that each one serves such a good purpose for the overall film that I don't mind it as much. And I mean, even when I watched the film, I was about an hour and a half in, and I thought it'd been like 15 minutes.
Yeah. And we talked about this with the hours, you know, how the hours feels like a stage play. The acting is very stage and all that. And it just kind of depends what you're into. Like if you can't buy into something with long drawn out scenes like this, like what happens in Burned by the Sun, then that's just not what you're into. And it's the same reason why, for as many people who love Quentin Tarantino, there's an equal amount who absolutely despise Quentin Tarantino because they don't want to watch people talk for 20 minutes about leaving a tip for a waitress who's not even going to be in the movie. They want it. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. And so, you know, I think that it's a little bit more difficult too when it's like an artsy Russian film in a subtitled language as opposed to being an English film, because then you might be a little bit more receptive. But really, this movie to me feels like the precursor for a lot of movies that have come since, both American and not, because like Call Me By Your Name, I saw so much of Call Me By Your Name in this movie, despite the fact that they're about two very different things. But I saw so much of that movie in Burnt by the Sun. And I just think, like, you know, that speaks volumes about how impactful a little movie from 1994 can be, despite the fact that it came out the same year as Forrest Gump, Shawshank Redemption, The Lion King, Quiz Show, Pulp Fiction, all of those movies that everybody talks about. Four Weddings and a Funeral came out that year, and it just had a Netflix show or Hulu or whatever the show was. And still, if you dig a little bit deeper than just the really popular ones, you'll still find movies that are impacting movies almost 30 years later.
Yeah, and like I said, this, it really feels like the perfect epitome of a post-Soviet film to me, because it really does take that 80 years of film development that happened before it in Soviet Russia and really utilize it well. I mean, some of the most prolific filmmakers of all time come from Russia, and you see the influences of Eisenstein in this film. You see the influence of Tarkovsky in this film, and Mikhailov is able to, at that same time, kind of elevate it to his own personal image of it. And it's just, it's so good as this character drama, that's this slow burn character drama paying off in the incredible second to last scene where the balloon goes up and you just have that giant banner of Stalin. And then that's when the terror of the situation really sets in.
Yeah. It's him watching over everything. I mean, you can never get away. And you know, it's a really interesting decision to show the picture of Stalin and Kotov right before that too, because we see that they've met each other and Kotov is convinced he's friends with Stalin, so he'll end up being fine. But again, like when it comes to this totalitarian type government or totalitarian type anything, you'll dump your friends to the side because you're going to find new ones who are going to be so scared anyway. You don't want anybody who's going to stand up to you. And even at the beginning, like, we see how legendary Sergei is. We see that everybody in the military respects him and they're scared of him. And he's able to come through and stop the tanks from rolling over the wheat and all that. And he's still a person of the people. And it's not what Stalin wanted. He doesn't want a person of the people. But Kotov felt so confident that he would be okay, everything would be fine because of his relationships and because of what he'd done, that it doesn't matter. He can say and do whatever it is he needs to say and do. And ultimately not really the case, as we see in the end of this movie. But another one that I thought of a lot while watching this as well was Life is Beautiful, which came out just 3 years later. But again, another one that's kind of told, trying to be told from the kid's point of view and trying to keep a lighter heart on a really dark subject. And some of the biggest criticisms I saw for Burnt by the Sun was that it was being too light. But at the same time, why would it be serious if it's a day off, it's the summer, and everybody's hanging out, having a good time as a family? It shouldn't be dark. It should be light, because that's how it would be if you were at a pool party all day and then you died in a car crash on the way home. You're not going to be miserable at the pool party all day because you were having a good time all day and you don't know what's coming in an hour.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's that contrast between the sunny summer day and the inevitable doom that Kotov is led to at the end of the film that really helps nail home these themes that are present in the film about terror and about totalitarianism and all these different ideas that Mikhailov decided to put forward are only amplified by that contrast.
Yeah. No, it's a very, very interesting movie. And it's one that I almost feel is very hard to properly assess after just one watch. I feel like it's definitely one of those. I remember In the Mood for Love, the first time I watched it, I hated it. Watched it again recently and actually quite liked it. Didn't love it. Still think it's overrated, but quite liked it. I think there's a lot of movies like that, though, where, and I think it happens a lot more with non-English films than with English-speaking films. Because if your first, whatever your first language is, you're going to understand a movie like that more the first time you watch it, just because you're able to visualize everything while taking it all in. But yeah. But if you're having to read it, you're kind of missing stuff, or you're just not realizing everything going on right away. And so, you know, this to me is a movie that requires a second viewing in order to properly get really what is going on in it. And especially with an ending like this, it's one that you should watch again so that you can properly respect what just took place at the end of that movie.
So I want to know your opinion on the ball of sun scenes.
So definitely confused me at first. I was definitely thrown off by what was going on. But I'm assuming that's just kind of the way of saying, no matter where you go, you're always under our watch. No matter what's happening, you're always being viewed in some way.
So I think we have to take into consideration the setting of the film when it comes to this idea of being burnt by the sun and the title of the film. And I think the sun more represents the nurturement and the happiness that the state provided for Sergei and how it in the end is his destructive force. That is still this powerful force that comes in. The first time we see the sun scene, there are two scenes of it. The first one, it comes into the house and it destroys the picture as Mitya's telling the fairy tale. Because that's kind of this turning point in this day where all of a sudden it's like, oh, we don't really like Sergei anymore. He's kind of a dick. And it's that real big turning point. And then the second time is when Mitya has killed himself. And I think it's just this idea of the things that nurture him. Why did Mitya kill himself in the end of the film? It's because he's ridden with the guilt that he knows, despite the fact that he kind of gets this revenge on Sergei for sending him away and taking away that life from him. He has now ruined the life of people he cares about by following through and taking Sergei away.
Yeah, and it's almost like this is the darker version of atonement, you know, where like atonement kind of follows a similar thing, something misunderstood, or you're going to get your revenge because of whatever it is. And in not that atonement isn't a dark ending, but the way that atonement ends is it's an older person who's now going senile and now they're thinking about it. In this one, you have the person who's like, you know what? I don't even want to live any longer. I don't want to go any further because I feel so bad about what I did. I just need to be done. And I also think that it speaks volumes about the differing countries and the differing beliefs where in England, it was always that idea that there was going to be a sunnier day on the other side. Same thing in America, North America, in Europe. There's always this idea that there's going to be a brighter sun. And in Russia, that doesn't necessarily feel like what's going on here. It feels like there is a lot more of, you know what, it might not ever get better. And so, like, to me, when I sat there and I watched that scene and it's showing his face with the sun going down, I'm like, wow, this is great. And then when it went to the bathtub, I'm like, okay, this is a professional working as a professional. You know what I mean? Like, this is somebody who is entirely in command of their craft and is doing this so purposefully. And it's a beautiful scene. And then you think about, you know, some garbage that has come out recently, but like with the Netflix show 13 Reasons Why, where it's like, how can we glorify this suicide scene? It's funny to see an artist do it compared to Netflix trying to attract 13 viewers.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's even better is that it's foreshadowed throughout the entire film. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I mean, this is going to lead back into Russian theater. Specifically, early in the film, they mentioned Chekhov. Mm-hmm. They specifically mentioned the Cherry Orchard, and we have a gun in the first scene.
Yep.
And we all know the rule of Chekhov's gun. Yep. A gun needs to go off. It mm-hmm. does eventually go off in that second last scene when they shoot the delivery driver. Mm-hmm. And they pass it off that he was an enemy of the state and he was helping Kotov escape.
Yeah.
We know that's not true because we've been mm-hmm. following this delivery driver the entire movie and he's just lost beyond belief. Mm-hmm. But they're able to pass it off because that is what was happening in that time in mm-hmm. the Soviet Union. But the other Chekhov's gun we have, when we're talking about Marussia's mm-hmm. scars, and they're on the bank of the river, and she specifically says, "I didn't realize you had to be in the tub to make it so that it didn't congeal."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know it's coming. It's
beautiful yeah. artistry.
Yep.
Because it's we've talked about it a few times with like twist endings and stuff like that. An ending like this has to be set up somehow. Mm-hmm. And it is set up throughout the entire film. And that's what makes it such a beautiful film.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are the moments that stick out because it does have a payoff. It does mean something. You know, we're going to get into 20th century women in a second here, but you know, something similar is when they're talking about how Greta Gerwig, the whole movie, she's never going to have kids. And at the end of the movie, when they do say, despite her doctor's order, she ended up having two kids. It's like, all right, like that's going to hit you more emotionally now because you've, mm-hmm. it's been set up for you. And that scene, while it might just sound like, yeah, they're talking about how, you know, we've seen him try to kill himself. Now we see that she's tried to kill herself. You don't necessarily put two and two together, but it's coming. And then mm-hmm. it comes. And it is an unbelievably powerful ending. And it's a movie that I will definitely revisit to see if I appreciate what comes before the ending even more because of how powerful that ending is.
And I mean, one last thing I really want to mention about this film mm-hmm. is the performances in this movie are absolutely incredible, mm-hmm. especially from our youngest lead mm-hmm. in this film. Like, to have someone that young perform so strongly as mm-hmm. Nadia, it's incredible that this is the caliber of acting in this movie.
Yeah, I totally, totally agree. She is phenomenal. When you can get a kid actor who can act, it elevates any movie with a kid, because when a kid actor can't act, holy crap, is it hard to watch. And she is phenomenal. And her performance with Sergei is just top notch, beautiful stuff. And yeah, they all feel like they are who they are. They don't feel like they're acting. They just feel like they are who they are.
Exactly.
A good call, John. You probably opened up a lot of people's eyes to Burnt by the Sun. A lot of people who had not seen the movie before. Now they have. Before we get to 20th Century Women, I will start off with the best thing we watched in these last 2 weeks, because I watched one movie, if you don't count all the Pixar shorts and such that are now playing in 3D at Disney theme parks as they come back from the COVID shutdown, and they're trying to fill some theaters because they don't know what to put in yet. But the only movie I watched this entire week was The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, Billy Wilder movie from, I believe, 1970. It was pretty good. It was definitely the worst of this series that we're doing right now, but it was a pretty good movie, a pretty fun little take on Sherlock Holmes. Fun. It kind of gets more into like a spy feel. It starts to feel more like a Bond movie as we start going on, but a fun movie. Robert Stevens, I believe it's Robert Stevens, I hope I'm not butchering his name, plays Sherlock Holmes. I almost called him James Bond. And he's a really fun, he's got the charisma for it. The Watson character is very well done. Billy Wilder is always entertaining. Grab him by the throat and never let go. That was always his motto. I got a couple Billy Wilder movies coming up in my list. And if I watched more Billy Wilder, I'd probably have even more. If you haven't seen a movie that's not on my list and not on John's, but I'll throw it out here to everybody anyway, Ace in the Hole, one of the best hidden gems you will ever see in movie history. Probably should be in my top 100, but I haven't seen it in so long that I can't do it. But check it out. It is about a cave collapse and a guy gets stuck in it, and a reporter played by Kirk Douglas keeps going back to the cave for his story, but he won't help the guy to escape because it's better for his story. It is so good, and it was made in like 55 or something. It's so good. So check that one out. But The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, definitely a fun, easygoing sit down. You don't want to think much that night, but you still want to have fun with a couple of fun mystery elements. Check out The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. But John, I'm sure you watched more than I did over the course of these last
years. I did. And there are a couple of good standouts. I mean, In the Heights was really good, but I've already named a bunch of musicals in this. What's the best movie I've watched this week? And I think it is kind of getting a bump from being that first movie back in a theater in 9 months. So for my for the best film I watched this week, I'm going to have to go with The Favourite.
Oh, love that.
Oh, fantastic film. Not what I was expecting that movie to be at all, but it was so much better. I it's a Yorgos film. I knew it was going to be good. I should have expected what did unfold in that film, but oh my God, absolutely incredible. Stellar performances from Olivia Colman, Rachel Weisz, and Emma Stone. Just all around great film and so easily accessible now on Disney Plus.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's not on Disney Plus in America. It's only not in the United States of America. It's only on Disney Plus up in Canada. But what a great movie. The Favourite is such a great movie. Yorgos is so bizarre. You'll never look at a bunny the same way again. And you'll never look at legs the same way again after watching that movie. Olivia Colman totally deserved her Oscar. The movie not winning Best Production Design and losing it to Black Panther is an absolute travesty. That's coming from somebody who hates Marvel movies, but at the same time, they are not even close. As Quentin Tarantino once put, they're not even the same effing ballpark. They're not in the same league. Get out of here. That was probably the worst Oscar win because of what it defeated. The production design in The Favourite is absolutely insane. The set decoration, the costuming, it's all just unbelievable. I'm fine with Black Panther winning costuming over The Favourite. We've seen The Favourite type costumes all the time, but the set design in that movie is unreal. And to make such a dark comedy out of something that people so often find boring, Emma Stone should have won the Oscar for it. Instead, she wins the Oscar. She had won the Oscar the year before, so they weren't going to give it to her back to back. But she should have won the Oscar for it. And thank God Olivia Colman won, because if Lady Gaga would have beaten Olivia Colman, woof. Anyway, love The Favourite. If you haven't seen The Favourite, John just gave you a must watch, because that movie is so freaking weird, but not nearly as weird as Dogtooth.
It's easily Yorgos' most accessible film. When you compare it to his other ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. I do agree. Cause Dogtooth, man, that might be my favorite of his movies. Cause it is weird. Anyway. All right. Let's talk 20th Century Women 2016 with Mike Mills and the incredible Annette Bening, who is unfortunately going to die without winning an Oscar, which might be the biggest travesty ever, other than Peter O'Toole. So from the female perspective, her not winning an Oscar is such a crime, considering all the great performances she's had from American Beauty all the way till this. Wasn't even nominated for 20th Century Women, which I think is just a crime, and people need to learn to sit down and watch movies that aren't Academy voters need to sit down and watch movies that aren't wide releases or directed by incredibly well-known directors, because she is so phenomenal in this movie. I think all of the acting from the top down is great. And just to me, it's Mike Mills. He also directed Beginners. If you haven't seen Beginners, Christopher Plummer won supporting actor for that. It's with Ewan McGregor and Melanie Laurent. And he is so good at making the smallest stuff feel like the most massive and making everything feel so important. And he just has a way of capturing all these things that people think about and all these things that people feel all the time in their life and making it relevant and not making it feel dated and making these people feel like people that you could live with and that you would see and that you want to understand better. He is so good at capturing human moments from everybody. And to set this in Santa Barbara during the hippie days, I love it. I love it. And this is one of my favorites of the last decade, without a question.
Yeah. And even the setting of Santa Barbara during the hippie days and the fact that we're not even really shown the hippie side of things, because we're at the punk rock side of things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We're on the complete opposite side of the spectrum from the hippie side. And it's such a great setting because it really goes to show the disconnect between the generations of these women and the men in this movie as well. It's phenomenal. It's hard to say which of the five main characters in this film, which actor performs the best out of them, because they're all so incredible.
Yeah, I think the biggest crime is that Lucas Jade Zuman hasn't really done anything since. Now, this is the kid from Sinister, for anybody who's wondering. This is the kid from Sinister. And he hasn't done anything since, really. This was his movie, and that was kind of it. He kind of just appears in little things here. But it's a shame because he's so good in this movie, and his camaraderie with the women and even with Billy Crudup. And Elle Fanning, Greta Gerwig, Billy Crudup, Annette Bening, I will say that out of all of their movies, out of all of them, and American Beauty is number two on my list. Out of all of their movies, these are the best performances of all of their careers. They are all unbelievable. I love Lady Bird. I think Little Women was great. This is the best thing Greta Gerwig's ever done. And I know she didn't direct it or write it, but just from like her artistic perspective, this is the best thing she ever done. Billy Crudup is phenomenal in this role. Despite the fact that nobody will really ever give Billy Crudup credit for being a solid actor, he is incredible in this role. And I think it's all because they're at the hands of Mike Mills, who's just a damn good director and a really incredible writer.
No, this movie, this is, again, like we were talking about the character relationships in Birth by the Sun, and that is all this movie is about. This movie is about self-discovery and the relationship between each of these characters. And Mills does, there are a couple of times where Mills does a phenomenal job in the cinematography for this film to demonstrate that. I think one of the best examples is when they're in the vineyard and he has it framed. It's on Dorothea centered. This was my one complaint about the movie was Mills used centering shots a lot.
I love that. That's the Wes Anderson.
I just wanted a little bit of variation because almost every single scene was centered and it almost felt like this is the important thing. But this film and this scene in the vineyard, when you look at it first, Dorothea's straight in the middle of the shot. It moves over to Jamie for his response. And then Dorothea, when it switches back to Dorothea, she's not in the center anymore. And she's on the opposite side of the frame where Jamie was, because it's really showing that at that point, the important thing isn't Dorothea, which is kind of what she's been led up to at this point, where she's just so focused more on herself than anything. It's then on the relationship between Dorothea and Jamie.
Yep.
And that's just such a beautiful shot.
And because what's happening throughout this movie, And you know, if you read the description, and John, I 100% agree, but if you read the description of this movie, this is what it says on Letterboxd. In 1979, Santa Barbara, California, Dorothea Fields is a determined single mother, in her mid-50s, who is raising her adolescent son, Jamie, at a moment brimming with cultural change and rebellion. Dorothea enlists the help of two younger women, Abby, a free-spirited punk artist living as a boarder at Fields' home, and Julia, a savvy and provocative teenage neighbor, to help with Jamie's upbringing. And so what this movie is ultimately about, and I think it's just funny to read that because that is what the movie is about, but it's not really what the movie is about. And what this movie is about is a mother and her son and their relationship. And how are they going to grow together as they move through their years? Because at the end of the day, no matter how close you are with somebody, no matter how close you are with a best friend or with people who grow up, the odds of you moving on from those people are always higher than moving on from your family, unless there's some sort of tragedy, unless there's some sort of, you know, crime or something committed. And so while she doesn't know what to do with him during these teenage years, she almost needs these women to help her more than she needs them to help Jamie, because she needs to discover what it is about her that she can bring to her son. And in the vineyard, I think he even says to her, like, why can't it just be us? I thought we were fine, just us. And you see her break. It's the first time Dorothea Fields breaks. And she's like, really? You thought we were doing great. And Annette Bening to me is the quintessential mother in film. Her role when she's talking to Thora Birch in American Beauty is unbelievable. When she starts talking about all the things that Thora Birch didn't have, or that Thora Birch has that she didn't have, all of those things. And it's the same thing here, where she's so good at showing that emotion of a mother who's like, you really think we were doing, you think I was doing a good job, and like how that makes her feel so happy, but she doesn't know how to express it. And yeah, I just think when this movie, when you read what it's about, nowhere in there does it say that it's about a mother and son and their relationship together. But that is all that this movie is about. That is all that this movie is about. While it is also about, you know, bigger themes of feminism and gender stereotypes and all, and the '70s leading into the '80s in general.
Yeah. And that again is one of those nice things about film is the interpretation that people can have coming out of it, because a quick description isn't going to say this is the story of a mother and son. It's going to focus on those big issue themes that are present of feminism and women's rights and gender inequality and stuff like that. But something has to unite those themes somehow in the movie, and that is this relationship between Dorothea and Jamie, and how it is almost non-existent at the beginning of the film.
Mm-hmm. They read the stocks together, and what is less human than the stock market? The stock market is a ticker. It's a machine. It just goes. And so, what's less human than that? There's nothing. But there's so many great lines in this movie. And you know, I always think like people want it to feel nowadays like, oh, well, that's exposition, or that's what we've taken it for granted so much. The style of a movie sometimes is to let you know you're watching a movie. And that's this movie to me. He's able to say things. His characters are very much are vocal or voice boxes for him. And I think there's a line in there where it's, they always say a boy needs a man in order to become a man. Well, I don't think that's true. And that shows like how Annette Bening feels in this movie, how all of the women feel in this movie. And also that like, there's this stereotype that if you grow up with just a mother, there's going to be something wrong with you. And, you know, back in the '80s, that's something wrong with you is that you would be gay. That was the something wrong with you. And that's not something wrong with you, but that's the view that it took on back then. And it's so interesting how this movie is taking such a stubborn age group and a stubborn generation, but putting her as the loner and giving her no choice but to interact with these kids and with these young people and with her pothead, whatever mechanic guy who just happens to be fixing up the house all the time, just captures it so incredibly well.
Yeah, exactly. And it the age differences in these characters is really important because we do really get that generational difference between them. Mm-hmm. Because there's so many times in this film where Jamie states she grew up in the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
To like try to justify Dorothea's reaction to things or the her actions in the film. And then you have
which character?
Greta Gerwig's character.
Okay, Greta Gerwig. Yeah, I totally forget her name in this. Abby.
Yeah, and you have Abby, and she's just that like 10 years older than Jamie and Julie, and it really goes to show the differences yet similarities between these age groups and the issues that they deal with.
Well, yeah, and it's I think it's an interesting perspective on this whole free love period too, because I believe this was more coming towards the end of that period, but then you start getting into the '80s where everybody, you know, the punk rock, we're gonna get into the scene and all that, and like here's Abby, who is, you know, staying in a boarding home, and she wants to be a photographer and she's trying to be as artistic as possible, and what can she do? But then she's also dealing with cervical cancer. And how is this going to impact her? Is this going to ruin her whole life? What can she do in the future? I never wanted a kid until he told me I couldn't have a kid. And then you have Julie, who being 10 years younger, you're starting to see that what kind of girl in the 50s or 60s would sleep in a guy's bed, even if it was like an asexual type thing, who would be doing? Nobody. You wouldn't even think of that. And so you're starting to see the trickle down of trying to rebel against what Dorothea Fields' generation was. And then how even the people Julie's age don't want to be the Abbeys of the world. They still want to be something even more different. You know, I look at it now, like we're both, what, 29 years old, unless you've hit 30, in which case, happy 30th.
Yet. Not there yet.
But we're both at 29 years old talking about our 80th favorite movie here. And, you know, us to an 18-year-old, we're like old, stupid people. You know what I mean? Like, that's just how it is. And that's what's interesting about Julie and Abby in this movie is I love the scene where Abby comes home drunk and she's sitting there and she's like, all right, Julie, don't listen. I'm talking to Jamie right now. And it's you cannot let her stay here. You cannot do it. And, you know, there's such a differing opinion there because Julie doesn't see anything wrong with it. She's just keeping company and we're really good friends. And, you know, but Dorothea would think that they were both stupid and that there was something wrong with both of them. So I love how it goes generational. It goes across genders. It goes across an era. You know, setting this in 1979 is hugely important. It's hugely important.
So definitely the decisions made. When it comes to setting in this film, we're very spot on. And while this is a story you can really tell at any time, this particular year was really important to get the emotional impact that this film gets.
Yeah, and speaking of the emotional impact, like I watched this movie and there are so many times where you just feel that pit in your throat and you feel that feeling in your chest of, oh boy, am I going to cry at this moment? Because the smallest things, the smallest lines of dialogue, there's such a sense of empathy for all of these characters from the way that Mike Mills portrays them. Yep. And there are so many emotional things that shouldn't be emotional. And I think about what my favorite parts of a Mike Mills movie are, and this is in Beginners as well. And I have, those are the only two movies by him that I've seen. I think they're really the only two movies he's made. He had Thumbsucker, but that was a long time ago. He did do the National I'm Easy to Find. But what I think is so compelling is when he starts doing the voiceover of people talking about other people or talking about their futures, because it's almost like saying to you, hey, John, if you could sit down right now and knew you were going to die in 20 years, what would you say about yourself now when you're going to die in 20 years? Or what would you say about your mother if somebody said, all right, just start talking about your mother? And some of these most powerful scenes are when Jamie is talking about his mom at the beginning, and this is what people looked like, and this is what the depression looked like, and all of that. And when Dorothea is talking about how she's going to die of lung cancer, but she was prepared for Y2K, but she never actually makes it to Y2K. And when they're talking about how Abby and they're all talking about themselves and where they go, how Julie will no longer talk to Jamie and Abby will do this and Billy Crudup's character will never find happiness and all that. All of these moments just want to make you lose it. Because they're all so well done. And the scene where Jamie almost dies, and that's when Dorothea's like, I don't know who this person is anymore. And for her to sit there and say, we're hearing it from her, despite the fact that we're seeing it, you're only supposed to pass out for a few seconds. Jamie was unconscious for 30 minutes. And you like you're watching the whole scene going, what's going to happen here? But because it's being told by the mother, somebody outside who's caring, who's scared, these are really powerful decisions, and this is not Martin Scorsese type voiceover. This is for an entirely different purpose.
Yeah, and we've talked about it before where voiceover kind of seems like a cheap storytelling technique because it's very much a tell, don't show technique, and we don't want to do that, especially in a visual medium like film where we do want to show rather than tell. But when it's utilized the way it is in this film, it just helps expand what we already are seeing and helps in the end with the close, with the ending voiceovers helps just helps wrap everything up neatly at the end. And at the beginning, when they're introducing all the characters, it means that we don't have to go through a bunch of scenes where we're developing these characters for important things that are coming further in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We don't have to give it all away. The fact that the car blows up and they go home to this house that is permanently under construction with one woman who just got test results and doesn't know what's going to happen. And then we have Julie who's just there and we're like, who is this person? We know everything we need to know. The fact that Dorothea is inviting the firefighters over lets you know everything you need to know about how lonely this person feels, but also how caring this person is. We don't need the voiceovers until later. And rather than throwing up at the end of the movie, like Burnt by the Sun does and a lot of great movies do, but rather than throwing up at the end, Dorothea Fields died, you have Jamie talk about how his mother was going to die. And you have her talk about how she was going to die and how she was going to find happiness again and everything like that. Maybe it's cheap. Maybe it is a cop-out to pull at your heartstrings, but it totally freaking works for me. It totally works for me. 20th Century Women is one of the most emotional movies I've ever seen in my entire life. And it comes down to the acting. It comes down to the screenplay. It comes down to the direction. And maybe above all else, it comes down to the music. Because what defines generations is the music. I really believe that. I think even more than movies, I think more than anything, you know, more than clothing and all that is the music. Because if you start playing the Rolling Stones, you can immediately picture all the Flower Children. If you start playing Zeppelin, you're starting to picture the Flower Children who are rocking out now. And they're starting to change. You start playing AC/DC or Guns N' Roses, you can imagine the hair. And in this movie, focusing on the punk scene, you can imagine the people with their cutoff jackets and the leather and all that. And I think that's what's interesting, too, is when a movie's being made in 2016, what is our generation's music? Because there is really no music that defines our generation because our pop is so varying. And then we have we have festivals for everything. And so I love that this was still set in a time where it's punk versus art bleep. There you go, John. I'm bleeping myself today. It's punk versus art bleep. And how do you use that? And all she and Billy Crudup want to do is listen to this nice, you know, lounge music. And I think Mike Mills does a phenomenal job with the music in this movie, and especially using the Talking Heads, which are such a transcendent band, and putting it up against Black Flag and things along those lines. It just works because those are still bands that people nowadays, if they're trying to be defined as punk or if they're being defined as classic rock people, those are bands they're going to listen to. And this is 40 years later.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And music is so powerful in film. Mm-hmm. And when, I mean, we see that with musical scores, we see that with, in musicals themselves, but it's when you use this, diegetic music in the film like this, and you're using these diegetic, sorry, for those who don't know, diegetic means movie that's or music that's actually in the film. Mm-hmm. So we have diegetic music and incidental music. Incidental music is like a soundtrack that we're hearing as an audience, whereas diegetic music is the music that is being the characters are hearing. And the use of diegetic music in a film can be so impactful because it helps you relate to characters so much better. Mm-hmm. Because you just get an understanding of them. And when we have Dorothea and William listening to the punk rock, and it's like, what is he saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, there are people who relate to that, where they listen to punk rock, and they're like, I have no idea what's happening. How is this relevant to anything? What do these words mean? But then there's the people, like this younger generation, who are like, yes, this is incredible.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I think it's Abby, she says it's the Raincoats, and they have no talent, but they have so much emotion. They have so much that they want to express that they need to find a way to do it, but they have no talent, and that's okay. And I think that's always the hardest thing. It makes me laugh that my dad's generation, my parents' generation, they'll sit there and they'll listen to a band like Neutral Milk Hotel, Jeff Bangham, for anybody who doesn't know, back in the, they released two albums in the 90s that are some of the best alt-rock albums of all time. And they'll sit there and say, his voice sucks. Why are you listening to this? And this is coming from the guy who grew up on Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Neil Young. Well, I listen to those albums in the car all the time. And I think it's just more of what does it mean to you? And that's why, you know, when people review movies, there is a difference between a good movie and a bad movie. There is no doubt about that. However, there's also movies that are going to hit you one way that might not hit another person. Everybody Wants Some is not one of the 10 greatest films of all time, but it is my 19th favorite film of all time, or whatever I have it at, because it just hits me in a way. And that's okay. But granted, there's movies like, you know, B movie 60s crap, or even the newer ones that come out that have no plot or anything like that, that aren't that good. But when it comes to music, whenever I see a music review, this album got reviewed, I think it's the funniest thing in the world, because it's literally all about what is pleasing to you. That is all music is about. While you could sit there and say The Room is inherently bad, that is a bad movie. There is no way to describe that as anything but a bad movie. Even when you put it in your top 100, you're putting it in there because you're entertained by how bad it is. I might hate Jay-Z. That doesn't mean everybody hates Jay-Z. And I think that's what's so stupid when it comes to music. And I think that's what this movie does a really interesting job of, is saying, I don't get it. I don't get it. I'm just going to have to be okay with that. And it even comes through in the politics of this movie, where they all sit down and watch the Jimmy Carter speech. And they're like, he is so screwed. And he certainly is, because he gets one term and then here comes Reagan. But Dorothea sits there and is like, I thought that was really nice. And it just, when it comes to all that stuff, it is so much your own belief and what you are feeling in that moment. And Mike Mills does a very good job with that. He does a very good job with that.
Yeah, he definitely does. And he definitely shows an understanding of these generational emotions that were so present in the time.
So I, this is one I wish Mike Mills did more movies. He released one. Beginners was 2010. This was 2016. The I Am Easy to Find was 2019, but that's more of like a, I've actually never seen it, even though I would love it, because I love The National and I love Mike Mills. But this is his last movie that he's made. He hasn't made anything. And in 11 years, he's made two movies. And we always talk about that, how sometimes that's better. Tarkovsky and Kubrick and when you take your time, Fincher, he takes his time more. Sometimes that's better, because they're really putting all that they have into this one project. And hopefully whatever Mike Mills has coming next, I can't wait for what it is. Just release something, Mike, because I'm sure I'm going to love it, because Beginner's very close to being in my top 100, but 20th Century Woman to me is just, it's just the better all-encompassing movie. But what he does a good job of too is he gets into gender roles, gender stereotypes. He gets into feminism. He talks about the LGBTQ community a lot in Beginners, because Christopher Plummer comes out as gay at like 80 years old. And he does it in a way that doesn't feel preachy, but it doesn't feel like it's skating around issues. It feels like it's very much trying to be involved, but it's also not telling you that you should feel one way or the other, such as Abby giving him the books about how to make a woman orgasm and all that fun stuff. And his mom's like, you don't need to be giving him this. This is not what he needs to be getting in fights at the skate park over. And that's just, it's so well done, because what, like, you understand as a parent why the parent doesn't want her 15-year-old kid reading that book, but then you understand why as a 27, 28, whatever-year-old woman, Abby, you would want a 15-year-old guy reading that book. And I think that's what's really compelling about how Mike Mills presents these issues that sometimes are just tried to be drawn with a black and white line.
Yeah, and I really like how when Abby does present that feminist literature to him, William chimes in with how great one of the books is.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Because, of course, William would read that book. Of course he would read it. Yeah. And William's character is a fascinating character to me, because for a movie that is about the women of this era, he is so out of touch while trying to be in touch.
Yeah.
And he's used throughout the entire movie, but he's okay with that. He's okay with just being that guy. Wherever it blows, that's where it blows. And that's compelling character, because – you know, we see that he never really gets his full happiness, because he doesn't really know where to find it. He doesn't know where to look for it. And when he talks about his past and he talks about his future, he's the same monotone, guess this is what life is kind of guy. And that's a very interesting way to not really give him. He never states, I was unhappy, I was happy. It just, this is how it was. This is what happened. This was my life. This is the journey I went on, whatever you'd want to say. And he seems content by the end of all of it.
Yeah, and Billy Crudup just completely blows it out of the water with the performance, too.
Yeah, one of my big complaints with this movie is that the only Oscar nomination it got was for writing. The acting, no acting, is really brutal. Because the acting in this movie is just so good from top to bottom. And unfortunately, I think it just gets missed sometimes. When people are so good, I actually think it gets overlooked because too much that character, and you almost don't realize the acting they're doing. And that's why it feels like a lot of times so many people will win for the Eddie Redmayne in The Theory of Everything type performance or something that's just so physical, over the top, blah, blah. And the Michael Keatons and the Bill Murrays and the Annette Bennings and all that. They never get the love. They never get the love, despite the fact that they should, because it's powerful. You know, it's powerful stuff, but they're almost too good because they disappear into the character in a way that it's hard to kind of put your finger on.
Yeah, exactly. It is one of those things that people, we talk about it a lot, where audiences can't disassociate actors from a character, and it negatively blows back on the actor because you dislike that character, right? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it doesn't blow back that way when it's a character you like or a performance that's so believable, and it just seems natural to the actor a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. And she lost to Emma Stone. So Emma Stone should have won the next year, and Annette Bening should have won this year, as far as I'm concerned. Oh, and Annette. Oh, yeah, that's right. Annette Bening won the Golden Globe for The Kids Are All Right, but then lost. Mm. Just going to keep dwelling on the fact that she has not won an Oscar, because she should have. And not for nothing, Elle Fanning and Greta Gerwig should have been up there against each other for this movie. Mm-hmm. And Billy Crudup, he just never gets love, man. He just never gets love. Never, ever, ever gets love. But this is to me, this is one of those movies that I don't care what your politics are. I don't care what your beliefs on the feminist movement is. I don't care what your beliefs on the 70s or 80s are. I don't care what your taste in music is. It's just a human movie. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't have to agree with everything, or you shouldn't disagree with everything that is taking place in a movie. You should be able to sit back and just watch a movie for what it is. And this is a movie with a lot of messages and with a lot of heavy themes. And even if you disagree with them, I still think it's just one of those movies you got to be able to just sit down and say, all right, let me just watch this for what it is and see. And let yourself be overtaken by it, because the emotion in this movie is second to none. It really is.
No, absolutely.
All right, that's what I got. My throat hurts. Diegetic music, though, that is going to be a big theme as we move through our top 100, because, you know, Mulholland Drive, one of the best diegetic music scenes, probably maybe the best in film history, is in that movie. But there will be a lot of diegetic film, diegetic music speak as we start moving through this. So study up on some of your favorite diegetic scenes, because Everybody Wants Some has that, Whiplash has that. John, I'm going from my list. I forget what's on your list, but Baby Driver.
Almost Famous.
Yeah.
We have a lot of diegetic music, and it really goes to show how much it elevates the art form.
Yeah. Even Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. You know, you could argue that Huckleberry Hound isn't not diegetic there, but it sure is an impactful part in that movie. But all right, that's this week. That is 20th Century Woman and Burnt by the Sun. If you haven't seen those movies, check them both out. They are heavy movies, but they are about humanity. And I think sometimes human movies get overlooked for more action driven or comedy or whatever. These are just human movies. That is all they are. And you're going to feel a wide range of emotions watching both. Next week, we're going on to our 79th best movies of all time. John has The Others, which I have a fun story regarding that from 2001. Ooh, I'm excited for that. And I have The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. However, we will not be watching The Return of the King because John has it higher up on his list. Only a couple more weeks, though. Instead, we're going to be watching Three Colors Red. Three Colors Red is the last movie in a trilogy. It is a loose trilogy. You do not need to watch all three, but I highly, highly recommend you do watch all three because it is a phenomenal trilogy. Three Colors Blue is the first one. Three Colors White is the second one. And then Three Colors Red is the third. And that is the one we'll be discussing next week. But I am going to rewatch it. I have the Criterion box set. It's actually at my feet right here because I am about to take another quick trip. So I need to bring it with me. But here is the Criterion box set for the Three Colors trilogy. So make sure to watch Three Colors Red especially, but watch all of them because they are so good. They're only like 90 minutes each. So they're quick watches. And it's an absolutely phenomenal trilogy. That is what we're doing next week. Hope you're excited for that. Pretty soon we will be getting into movies that both of us had on our list. Because in about 5 weeks, John does have The Return of the King. And thanks to John, we will be watching Lord of the Rings in reverse order. We will be going from Return of the King to Two Towers to Fellowship of the Ring, as all should watch this series. But yeah, so even though my 79 is Return of the King, we'll be talking Three Colors Red. So make sure to check all of those out. No, I am not talking about the Bruce Willis, Helen Mirren, Morgan Freeman movie Red. I am talking about Three Colors Red from 1994 and the others from 2001. Follow us over on Letterboxd. We'll be much more active now that I am back from the most magical place on earth. And that's it. I'm excited to get back to some movies. I'm excited that we're into this, and I'm excited that we are in our top 80 movies of all time. 21 down and 79 to go. Thanks for listening, everybody. John, thanks for being here. Thanks for coming back after a 2-week hiatus. And we'll see everybody next week with another episode of Movie Buff Specialists.